Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is poet, educator, and publisher Teresa May Chuck. Chuck was born in Saigon and immigrated to the U.S. under political asylum with her mother and brother after the Vietnam War. She is a graduate of Goddard College in Vermont and is the author of two full-length collections of poetry, Red Thread and Keeper of the Winds. Her most recent collection is a chapbook called How One Loses Notes and Sounds, published this year by Word Palace Press. Some of her work is forthcoming in an anthology called Inheriting the War, Poetry and Prose by Descendants of Vietnam Veterans and Refugees. She is also the founder of Shabda Press, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tish.
Now tell us a bit about your early life. I know you came to the U.S. with your mother and brother from Vietnam. To tell us if you have any memory of that. You were 2 years old.
Yes, I was about 2.5 years old when we fled the country in a freight boat with over 2,500 people, and we spent 3.5 months in the ocean in the South China Sea. And I think even though I was so young, my body remembers. I think our body in our muscles and cells, they carry the memory that we experience. And I also hear stories from my mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To tell us, too, you and your brother and your mother came across, but your father had to stay in Vietnam, and he was in a re-education camp for 9 years. You must have heard so many stories from him when he came back, too.
Well, it was really hard for him to talk about it for a while. In recent years, he was able to tell me more about it. But he served in the Ministry of Law as a captain in the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, which was the South Vietnamese Army that was fighting with the Americans. And at the fall of Saigon, he told me that he had a gun, because he always carried a gun, and he was going to shoot himself, as a lot of generals and a lot of captains at that time did the same thing, and some actually did commit suicide because they knew what they were in for when the People's Army came down and took over Saigon. So my mom was pregnant with me at the time, and she convinced him not to. So he stayed, and what happened was they told him to report to re-education for 10 days, to pack enough food and clothing for 10 days. And then he disappeared. For the first year, my mom didn't even know where he was. And they took him way up north, close to the border of China, in a jungle. And that's where he stayed for 9 years. But he didn't have a sentence, because when you're in a Viet Cong re-education camp, you don't know when or if you will ever be released. My mom told me that that night that my father reported, they came to my mother's home and knocked on the door and asked where he was. And if he didn't leave, if he didn't report when he was supposed to, he would have been taken outside and shot dead.
Oh, the so horrible stories. Of course this is in your blood and in your consciousness in so many ways. Yeah. So when did you decide to turn to writing and start writing poetry?
Well, it was very difficult growing up. When my dad came and he had post-traumatic stress disorder from his experience through the war and also spending 9 years in a prison camp. Mm. And I experienced that. I experienced a lot of the anger, the anxiety, and even abuse. He didn't have any support system. So there was a lot I needed to process, but it was a very difficult subject matter for me. I didn't even want to read about the Vietnam War. My body would actually physically shut down or not want to face it. Mm-hmm. So growing up, I knew these things were still following me. I had a lot of issues with sometimes anxiety and sometimes with connecting with people because of my relationship with my father. So then I knew that I had to face this. I had to process the war. I had to learn about what happened, because what I wanted to do was I wanted to forgive my father. mm-hmm. for not being there to understand. As a very young child, you know, I would see in preschool, kindergarten, my classmates having their father with them or their father picking them up from school and holding them and having that. And I always wondered as a little girl, where's my father? And my mom would tell me he's in prison. And I'm supposed to try to wrap my little mind around prison and war.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
What did my father do? Who did this to him and why?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The suffering. I would see my mom alone and working so hard by herself, and my brother, who is 3 years older than me, and I, and having his absence. So that affected me. And then his, I think what he did when he came to the U.S. was he had no guide. He had to find his place in the family again. Mm-hmm. He had to find his sense of home again because he lost his home. He lost his country. He yeah. lost the war.
Yeah.
He lost his family. So coming back to the family to find his place as the father and what he knew, it took me a long time to try to understand why he behaved the way he did. And I think he had to try to find his place and his what he knew from his 9 years in prison. He kind of took on the role of his captors.
Oh, yeah,
and so
that
he
makes
was
sense.
A disciplinarian, yeah. Very, very strict.
And so, you tried to work through all this stuff by becoming a writer and,
yes.
and finding your own voice in some ways.
Yeah, I think I had instances, for example. I couldn't use my left hand to write. That was actually our first dinner together. My father said, you can't use your left hand to write or eat or I won't love you and you'll get punished. And my childhood was a series of punishments. If I forgot to say good morning, I would be punished. If I forgot to say hello or
wow.
good night. If I didn't put the sauce back at the exact same spot where I got it, I would get punished. And I had, you know, a knife thrown at me because I was caught using my left hand. I was hiding and doing my homework at the living room table behind a pot of plant, and he was in the kitchen, and I thought he didn't notice me, but he did, and the knife missed my face by about
oh my
an
God.
Inch. And another time, like, he chased me with an axe, and he was going to kill me.
Oh, Teresa,
and
no wonder you.
And my mom was literally blocking me and saying that he had to kill her first.
Oh,
and this
God.
Is because I didn't wash the dishes well enough. And I didn't listen to him. So I couldn't understand this. It took me so long
yeah,
to understand
I
that
understand
what
it.
He went through in prison. And this must be what he went through and what he knew. And this is what he brought home because he to give him a sense of control.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
Teresa, I do want to have you read from the collection. And,
okay.
And we'll be talking about this all through this.
Okay.
The poem from the new collection, How One Loses Notes and Sounds. This is Quan Am on a Dragon. Tell us just a little bit about it and then read it for us, please.
Okay, Quan Am is the Bodhisattva of compassion. She's also known as Gunyam Posat in Cantonese. In Mandarin, her name is Guanyin. She's also Avalokitesvara in Sanskrit, Chinrisig in Tibetan. And this is based on a true story. Quan Am on a Dragon. Mother shows me a lacquered painting on a plaque of Quan Am, Bodhisattva of compassion, riding a dragon. It is misty around the Bodhisattva and the dragon. The picture looks so real, almost like a photo. A sacred vase in one hand and a willow branch in the other to bless devotees with the divine nectar of life. Mother says that she and other boat refugees saw Quan Am as we were fleeing Vietnam after the war in a freight boat with 2,450 refugees. When she looked up towards heaven in the clouds, she saw the Bodhisattva in her white flowing robe riding a dragon. Mother says that the goddess was there to guide us and save us from the strong waves of the South China Sea. I should know better than to believe her, though she swears it's true. I ask again, and she nods, says, really, I saw Guan'am in the clouds as we were escaping. I should know better than to believe her. But a part of me wants to believe in a bodhisattva, in compassion riding on a mythical creature, to believe that somehow, something, more than just our mere human selves, wanted us to live.
Wow, that's a beautiful piece. You know what I'm going to ask you, too? Has it been hard for you to figure out how to portray other people's stories in a voice that you were struggling to find for yourself? And how have you done that? Telling other people's stories through your own consciousness in some ways, and probably worrying about whether you're being true to it or being authentic. To tell us how you've struggled through that.
Well, I think I'm trying to tell the story as honestly and as close to what I know to represent it in a way with integrity and compassion for the people in the story. Like, this story has to do with my mother and my family, but I know that it's more than that. It represents many, many refugees. Mm-hmm. And some refugees had even worse situations than we did. And I think by being as personal and zooming in as closely as possible to our human experience, that I can connect to the greater human experience of people who were in similar situations, including other refugees from other countries, like the Syrian boat refugees, mm-hmm. right now.
Yeah, because reading your work, it seems so authentic and so deeply felt. It's amazing to me that you were able to do that. But, you know, as a poet, I understand that you must know that your first breath was taken in an atmosphere of war, right? I mean, that's where all this probably even started. Yeah, it really amazes me the way you've been able to take this on.
Thank you. I think even before my first breath, actually, my mother told me that we were in bomb shelters when she was pregnant, and she could hear the bombs falling. I think that vibration through the air, I'm sure I felt it in the amniotic fluid.
Oh, yeah, and I'm certain you must have felt your mother's anxiety and fear.
Yes.
During that time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's have you read another from the collection, How One Loses Notes and Sounds. This one's called Agent Blue. Tell us a little bit about it, too.
Okay, so a lot of people are familiar with Agent Orange, but the U.S. use a lot of different chemicals, Agent Blue, Agent White, and the U.S. military knew that in order to completely destroy the Vietnamese people, they had to take out their food supply, which the main food supply and giver of life to the Vietnamese people is rice.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a chemical used to destroy that food supply and to kill the Vietnamese people.
Go ahead and read it for us.
Agent Blue. To kill correctly takes calculation, down to a science. Arsenic, cocodylic acid. No water and rice on a cellular level. Make sure no surviving seed can be collected and planted, because even a small seed assures survival. Because mortars, grenades, and bombs cannot destroy a grain. Because our heart is made of seeds. Know what it takes to kill the seeds. Know what it takes to deprive the plant of water, to dehydrate it, to be surrounded by love but unable to absorb it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Teresa May Chuck. We're talking about her new chapbook of poetry called How One Loses Notes and Sounds. Now I know you came to the U.S. as a 2.5-year-old, and you ended up in California. Was there ever a time when you were growing up in California when you said, Mom, Dad, I don't want to hear about this anymore. I'm growing up as an American child. I want to see the beauty in the world and not hear about war stories. Did you ever rebel in that way?
I think growing up in America, I was always walking between two cultures. Mm. And I really didn't want to know about this. I didn't want to hear about it. I wanted to be happy. I wanted my life to be normal like everyone else's. Mm-hmm. But I think the trauma is so intergenerational. It's passed on our DNA that I had to deal with it. And the way I had to deal with it was separate it from my body. So that's how poetry comes into play and writing, because by separating this from my body, I was able to remember it. I didn't have to forget it, but I didn't have to remember it. And I think what helps us create our identity, our experiences, our past, our history, we tend to hold on to because it's what makes us who we are. Mm-hmm. And the traumatic experiences of war and immigration was such an important part of my life and made me the person I am today. So I know I was holding on to a lot of that memory, but I didn't want to because it was really difficult to carry such weight in my body. Mm-hmm. And so by writing it down, I was able to separate it from my body. It was such a relief that I knew I didn't have to forget. I can still remember it, but I didn't have to carry it in my body in that way again.
Yeah.
So it was incredibly healing.
You turn it into something beautiful and still true. Yeah. That's what an amazing revelation that must have been.
Yes.
Now, I want to ask you this, too, because obviously I'm an American. I was young during the Vietnam War, at least our aspect of it. We know the French were there before. Growing up in California, you must have mainly heard the narratives about the Vietnam War from the soldiers. And then you were hearing this other from the victims, so to speak. I mean, your parents obviously got out, but the country was victimized, obviously. How did you negotiate around that?
Yeah, that was very, very difficult for me because growing up, I kind of felt like we weren't very important. And when I read about the war and when I watched movies, it was about the American soldiers' perspective. And mm-hmm. they were so great and looming in the storyline. Mm-hmm. And we were kind of background, kind of not really existing as our own beings.
You were props.
In our own humanity. Yeah. So I kind of felt like, is this how we are for a while? And then when I started to realize that, you know what, we have our own stories. I want my children to remember these stories. I want the world to know that it's more than just the perspective of the soldiers. We are people, we're human, and we have our stories. And as they say, history is often told in the perspective of the victors, and that's mm-hmm. how it was in the history books at school, and that's what I hear from people about the Vietnam War.
But Americans don't think they won this war. I mean, most of us know that we didn't. But obviously, we came back with the stories of being the aggressors.
Yeah. So maybe victors isn't the right word, but the ones in power.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The ones in power who, mm-hmm. in this case, were the Americans. So they weren't, I don't think, ready to focus on our lives, the immigrants, and what happened to us and the South Vietnamese people and the North Vietnamese people.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we're still trying to reconcile that. I'm still hoping to hear more stories from people in Vietnam, from Vietnam, about the war. I mean, obviously, we've just gotten the American side. And I know in an interview you mentioned When Heaven and Earth Change Places, Lehi Hayslip's. I read that in the early 90s when I was living in the Netherlands. It's the first book I ever read by somebody who actually went through the war from the other side, what we call the other side. Amazing book. It changed your life too, didn't
it? Yes. Yes, it did.
Wow.
It did.
So we need more stories like that. So I'm so glad you're writing this poetry. Let's have you read another one from How One Loses Notes and Sounds. This one's called Family. And this is a really disturbing poem to me. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, the boat refugee experience varied in intensity. It was a very difficult experience Some people, like my aunt, she was in a small boat, and her boat was attacked by pirates about 7 times, and they would rape all the women, steal from them, and if the men tried to stop, they would kill them and throw them overboard. Hmm. And my aunt was 8 months pregnant at the time, and she lost her child. She had to sit next to the hot engine. And for other boat refugees, it was even worse. So many boat refugees drowned because the countries they were trying to reach and hope that they would accept them, like Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore, didn't want to because they were already so full of refugees. And some of them would have to purposely sink their boats. And some whole families would drown. And then this, when I read about this situation that my poem addresses, I was just so shocked. And it was kind of the epitome of the boat refugee experience.
Okay.
Kind of the most unimaginable, yeah, but true. Family. After the war in Vietnam, boat refugees. When they woke up in the morning, all that was left was the skeleton, the bones of the father, his flesh, not already eaten by his wife and children, was stolen and eaten during the night on the island. On the day he was dying, he suggested that his family eat his body to survive. The flesh, dried up in the strong sun of islands, would be eaten like dried meat, beef jerky, a gift.
God, that's an amazing poem. That must have been so hard to write. Yeah. Now, I want to ask you this, too. Have you visited Vietnam in the last 30 years?
Yes, I actually went back last summer. It was a very, very important trip.
Uh-huh.
I went to Hanoi, which was where my father was born and my grandmother was born. And I actually have a good friend that I met in Boston, and Uncle Quang, I call him, and he served in the North Vietnamese Army. He's a writer.
Wow.
He's a novelist. And we met at the William Joyner Center workshop at the University of Boston. And it was so wonderful to meet him and other North Vietnamese writers and to hear each other's stories and have compassion for each other and to just look at each other and see each other as human beings and even treat each other as family when 40 years ago we would have been killing each other.
Exactly, yeah. God, that must have been amazing.
Yeah, and it was very healing going back because he took care of me and his family took care of me, and I really felt I was at home, and I visited other places and saw my country and went to Saigon, saw the Peace Village, which is the Agent Orange village with still many, many kids.
Did you feel ghosts? It feels like there should be ghosts in places that have been so badly damaged.
Yeah, I think everywhere. I went to Con Son Island, which houses a system of prisons, which include the tiger cages.
Oh, yeah.
It was originally built by the French during the French occupation, and then the Americans reopened it and used it to imprison communists and sympathizers. But going back there, I was called by my Vietnamese name, too, which is Duệ.
Duệ.
Mi Duệ. And so that was amazing. That's the name on my birth certificate. So my name was changed when I came here. And to hear that and to feel my motherland embracing me again is incredible. It's kind of like the feeling, you know, growing up and feeling like your mother abandoned you or didn't want you,
mm-hmm,
and then finally, like, meeting her again. And I know my umbilical cord is part of the earth there.
Yeah.
Now I'm tied to it, whether I want to be or not.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing to be able to come full circle that way. Now, before we run out of time, I want you to read one final poem.
Okay.
This one's called Praying at the Cemetery on Con Son, I, on, on... Konsun Island. Go ahead and tell us about it.
So this was when I went to Konsun Island, and it was a very important pilgrimage for me to come here. Praying at the cemetery on Konsun Island, endless gravestones, unnamed, a yellow star on each stone lights the night. I try not to breathe in spirits, but I breathe in the smoke of incense. A bat flutters by. A green grasshopper lands by my foot. Someone is saying hello. Perhaps it is a girl who died in a tiger cage. There are not enough incense sticks for all of the graves on Konsun Island.
Wow, that's a beautiful one. That has, in some ways, to do with healing, right? I mean, obviously.
Yes, and offering the incense sticks. This is what we do traditionally. We offer the incense sticks to our ancestors and to the deceased, and prayers, and to go there and to pray to these people that died innocently and to pay my respects to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a lot of these people died in the hands of the U.S. military.
Yeah.
To go there. It was, I think, as you say, a full circle, something I felt I really needed to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's so remarkable to me that you've been able to write about this in such a poignant way, you know? I don't sense anger. I mean, you've said in your biography that I've read that compassion and forgiveness is what you're searching for.
Yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think so. I think that's the way we can heal and to build bridges is through compassion.
Mm-hmm. And we only have about a minute left. What are you telling your children? Do you want them to relive some of this, or are you trying to steer clear and just let them read the beautiful poetry about it?
Well, I think when they're ready, I think it's important that they know the history of our family, to know that we didn't just have everything that we have now and what we went through, so they can understand, because they can read the poetry, the documentation. So I don't want them to have to go through as much of the processing that I had to go through, but I do want them to remember the history.
Yeah, and your beautiful words will definitely lead them down that path. Can you give some contact information? People can get in touch with you. Website. Also, Shabda Press. We don't have time to talk about it, but give us the website for your press and for you personally.
Okay, my personal website is tue-wai.com, which is Dwe Wai, which are my two names, my Vietnamese name Dwe and my Chinese name Wai. I'm mixed. And my press's website address is shabdapress.com, which is shabdapress.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Teresa Maychuk, thank you so much for joining us. Again, her new collection is called How One Loses Notes and Sounds. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story.
Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.